like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and the first item is the minutes. Representative Olson?
I'll move the minutes from the February 19th, 2020 meeting.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The first item of business today is the issue, and it's been debated now for a number of years, is whether inflation should be included and in the forecast, and it's currently mainly a footnote when the forecast comes out in terms of what the inflationary cost would be. There are some accounts, I think mainly in Health and Human Services, that do have an inflationary adjustment. But just very quickly, the decision not to include inflation on the expenditure side was an agreement between the Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe at the time and the House Majority Leader Tim Pawlenty. Both of them were running for governor, and one way that they dealt with a deficit that was before the legislature was not recognizing inflation. And so that helped them balance the books at the time. So it was a bipartisan agreement at the time. But since then, it's been frequently debated as to whether we should include inflation or not. And historically, before that, Mr. Marks may touch on that, we did. So the first presenter is our chief fiscal analyst, Mr. Marks. Mr. Marks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And you should have a folder there with two items in it that I provided. The first one has handwritten across the top, the November 2019 forecast, MMB. And that first page in there is just to show how MMB provides the inflation information currently. This is page 8 from the forecast document from November. And if you look at the chart at the bottom of the page, you can see the line that talks about forecast revenues, projected spending, the difference, and then estimated inflation applied to projected spending. And there's a footnote that explains a little bit how it's provided or how it's calculated there. And the inflation amounts, a key thing here, the inflation amounts, when we've looked at them, are not for the biennium for which appropriations are being made or have already been made, but for the next biennium, the biennium that we typically call the tails. That's the where the discussion about inflation has taken place. So in this forecast, it's fiscal years 22 and 23, not the years 20 and 21 for which appropriations have been made, but the next biennium out. The next page in your handout provides some more in-depth information how the calculation's actually done. In this particular chart, I've included fiscal 20 and 21, but fiscal 22, 23 are the relevant years there. And as the chair mentioned, there are some areas where the assumption is that inflation is already in the forecast. What this shows is taking the total, the first line is the total expenditures and transfers line from the fund balance. And then there are five areas that are backed out or subtracted before the inflation calculation is done. Special education aid in the K-12 education area. And as the footnote explains, that there's already an inflation factor essentially in that because it's a cost-based formula. Debt service aid, the payment for paying principal and interest on general obligation bonds is backed out. And that's not because inflation's in it, but because there will be no inflation on that. When bonds are sold, the principal and interest are set, and they're not going to change because of inflationary pressures. Capital projects is also backed out, and this is a similar one. The capital projects line is paying debt service on appropriation bonds, and then also is the cash, if there are cash appropriations for capital projects are in that line, again, there would not be inflationary pressures because those amounts are already known. Then managed care and long-term care in the Health and Human Services area, these are taken out or excluded from the calculation because the forecast for those recognized as changes in cost, to the extent that supplies change or provider costs change, that's recognized in the formulas there. And then finally, property tax refunds are excluded, again, because there's a formula in statute that is essentially a dollar amount. It's the property tax refund is going to be the difference between a couple numbers, and that's not going to have additional inflation applied to it. So you can see, if you look at the last column on the page, the total general fund spending for the 22-23 biennium is projected at $51.2 billion. After these subtractions, there's $34.3 billion remaining, and that's the amounts that inflation is applied to. And then from the November forecast, the consumer price index calculation here, and this is the consumer price, it's the consumer price index dash U, or the, and it's taken from the IHS market forecast, which is what MMB, the national forecast that MMB receives. So these are essentially national CPI numbers. And then those CPI numbers are applied to the spending in each year. And it's 2.2% for fiscal 22 and 2.5% for fiscal 23. These CPI numbers will change again when we get a forecast later this week, and they're going to be slightly lower. But the first year calculation is a simple calculation, 2.2% times the $17 billion. The second one is a compounded one. It's taking 2.2% times the number and then 2.5% times the number, because the first year inflation would apply and then the second year inflation would apply. So you can see the calculation by year, $383 million, $383.7 million in 22, $827.4 million in 23. The sum of inflation then, the $1,211 million for that biennium, that's with applying inflation to those, or subtracting certain selected items, but applying inflation generally across the rest of the spending items in the budget. The third page in the handout, I provided some consumer price index information, some history on consumer price index information from 1960 through 1990s, every 10 years, and then from 2000 to 2024 are the annual numbers. I would just point out 2009, we actually had a negative consumer price index, so that makes for interesting calculations in that, or would make for interesting calculations in that year. Then, as far as a historical perspective, I want to jump to the other handout in there, which is an issue brief that was published in 2002, right after the inflation language in statute was repealed. This is 18 years old, but the information is still fairly relevant as far as the history in it. The chart in the middle of page one of that, I just want to mention that, because that essentially shows the calculation. This is going back quite a few years, but if you had $1 million appropriation, $1 million base level here, and what we use to calculate those tails, there is language in statute defining the base for future years as the appropriation in the last year of the current biennium. So in this particular example, the fiscal year 2003 number of $1 million is what's carried forward into 2004 and 2005. And then in this example, the inflation was at 2.5% per year. But you can see then the calculation, the $1 million in 2004 would have been estimated at $1,025,000, and in 2005 at $1,050,000. And just to think about it here, that's as any spending decision is made. If inflation is in place, then those numbers need to be added to it. In this handout, then on page two, is a list of the dates of forecasts, and inflation was actually added in the forecast beginning in the November 1991 forecast. The language in statute requiring inflation was not in statute until the 1994 session, but the Department of Finance then, the the former Department of Finance, now Minnesota Management and Budget, started adding it in forecast beginning in November of 1991. And you can see the inflation percentages, and then in the last column you can see the dollar amounts for each year. The years November 1993 through November 1996 were complicated by an additional factor, and this was one of the results of having inflation in the forecast was that the forecast in the out years or the tails years was not balanced in those years, and compromise at that time to try to get it balanced was that there were caps added into various formulas or into various bills. And in 1993, the education bill, the higher ed bill, and the health and human services bill had caps placed in them. And in 1995, it was only the education bill. But those caps were absolute statements that the appropriations for education or higher ed or health and human services in the tails years would not exceed a certain dollar amount. So we had inflation built into the forecast, but then the law came along and said, but we are not going to count it in these for these particular bills in those years, so that the out years would be balanced. So that's why the dollar amounts in those particular years, the inflation amount, are considerably lower. So that just some history of the times when inflation was actually counted in the law. On page 3 of that issue brief, that the end of the last paragraph, just wanted to read a statement here which embodied one of the conflicts with this. That last three sentences there. The forecast book goes on to say, the inclusion of discretionary inflation is not intended to suggest that inflation will be built into the fiscal 1994 budget base. Rather, it helps establish an upper bound on the state's current law obligations. The estimates make no assumptions about possible recommendations by the governor or actions by the 1992 legislature. And this statement sort of brings up the conflict that putting inflation in or not having inflation in brought about was that, and I'll illustrate that with some examples in a couple minutes, but if inflation was added in each budget category, then there was an assumption that's going to be added to the appropriation in the next legislative session or when the next budget was done. And we struggled, I recall a number of meetings with Department of Finance in those years about how to portray inflation so that so it was illustrating that there were cost pressures there, but so it wasn't creating a sense of entitlement to that money, so that if the money was in education or in higher ed or in the inflation money, that it wasn't necessarily going to go there. And that was always a struggle when the inflation was there, is how to deal with it, how to look at it, and how that didn't create a new base for the next budget that already built in the inflation amount. In that handout, there's some discussion on the spending caps, and then there's some in discussion about how inflation was applied at different times. I want to go back to the other handout, the one that had the forecast on the front page, just to illustrate how inflation was built into the fund balance statements in various years. And there's a page in there that at the top of it says February 1996 forecast. It's the one right after the Consumer Price Index. But handwritten on the top is February 1996 forecast. And then about a third of the way down, I drew some lines across the page with the Voyageurs National Park Advisory Commission and the Science Museum of Minnesota included, just because those appropriations were set in those particular years. You can see the 1994 and 95, those are actual spending numbers. This was the February 1996 forecast, so those were actually past fiscal years. And then in the middle columns on there, 1996-97, you can see if you look at the Science Museum of Minnesota, the second one there, the appropriation was $1,108,000 in both 1996 and in 1997. And then if you look at the last set of columns for 1998 and 1999, The planning estimate is $1,141,000 in 1998 and $1,175,000 in 1999. That was simply taking the $1,108,000 from 1997 and adding the planning estimate inflation to it. And the same is done for the Voyageurs National Park Commission. So it actually added it to each line item in the fund balance and did that kind of calculation. And you can see how that could create an assumption that our base for 1998 is $1,141,000 and our base for 1999 is $1,175,000. So while it was the statement in the fund balance was, or the statement in the forecast book was, we're trying to look at what the pressures are, this created an assumption that that's the base level for that program. The next page, which is the February 1998 forecast, so 2 years later, shows another evolution of how inflation was illustrated. And near the top of the page again, or a quarter of the way down, the same two agencies, Voyageurs National Park Advisory Commission and Science Museum of Minnesota, all three sets of columns here are for the same biennium, 2000 and 2001, from the 1998 forecast. And you can see how the calculation, in this particular case, there was a separate set of columns for inflation. So there was, here's the forecast base, here's inflation, here's the planning estimate when we add inflation to the forecast base. So a different way of attempting to estimate it, to try and change the message a little bit, and whether that was successful or not, I don't really know, or don't really want to say. But. And then the last page in here is from the December 2001 forecast. And this is the front page of the forecast, so it looks different. But the way inflation was shown was completely changed so that it was pulled out of all the different line items in the budget. And about in the middle of the page where I've put arrows on each side of the page, there was one line added in, very similar to the way it's done now in the forecast. And you can see that it says estimated inflation. So rather than adding inflation to each line item in the budget, it was a total number down at the bottom as a way of, here are the inflationary pressures in this budget, but we're not looking at the inflationary pressures of the Science Museum or of the Voyageurs National Park Advisory Commission. We're looking at it as a sum. So I think, Mr. Chair, I'll stop with that. I just wanted to get some sense of how it was, when it was in place and how it was illustrated in the forecast documents.
Okay, and I want to mention we're going to have a presentation informational on a bill by Representative Schultz. Actually, there are two bills in the Ways and Means Committee that were held in Ways and Means Committee. They were introduced last year, but because they're dealing with the forecast, which is the purview of this committee and not necessarily one of the divisions, both bills were held there. I have one and Representative Schultz has the other. They're virtually identical, but Representative Schultz will be doing a presentation on that. And you might ask, well, why are we hearing this particular topic at this particular time? The end of the month, February 28th, we come out with the forecast, and so that makes the whole discussion of inflation and how that's applied, in my view, relevant to having some information prior to the release of the forecast. So that's the purpose this morning. I think we've got time for maybe just a couple of questions of Mr. Marks, if need be. We are going to take testimony because, you know, in other bills, the testimony has taken place in the various divisions or other committees. And as you know, we have committee discussion, and that's whether we're in the majority or the minority caucus when they're in the majority. But these are bills that did not go to divisions, and therefore we are going to take testimony here this morning from a variety of groups. And because there are several, we've given them some pretty strict time guidelines as well. But any questions of Mr. Marks, or shall we move directly to an overview of the bill? Representative Kowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Marks. Mr. Marks, have there been similar, you know, certainly inflation could be applied to the state budget, as you've outlined, has been attempted or done in the past, to look at you know, the growth needs of government. Past legislatures looked at the impact of inflation on families and their ability to pay taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm not aware. I'm sure that has been done. I'm not aware of formal reports where that's been stated, but I am sure various groups have looked at that. I don't know that the legislature as a whole has.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Mr. Chair, I think that would be a great discussion for us to have, too, if we're going to look at the inflationary needs of the government. It would be good to look at, actually, the inflationary realities that the people paying for the government have, and certainly a good bill for us to look at as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Marks, there are several choices relative to the projections for inflation, and we are using which one?
Mr. Chair, this uses the Consumer Price Index, and that's the Consumer Price Index is what's been used all along when inflation has been calculated, when the various calculations have been done by MMB in the budget documents. It's actually Consumer Price Index-U for urban consumers, and it's a national figure that is what's used.
And sometimes you ask a question when you know the answer to it, but I wanted to put that out there. Because I think, Representative Drazkowski, that in part that gets at your question, because it's the Consumer Price Index, which when that measurement is used, that's the impact on consumers, which would be, in my view, the general public, the taxpayer, and so on. Often we have those kinds of discussions as to what the cost of living is going up, and that's what those percentages were that were shared in the presentation. Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that gets at some of it, but we have to also look at how that impacts the family's ability to pay, and that goes one step further, because we here in government simply execute these taxes upon the population of Minnesota without taking into account the squeeze that has on their budget. So that would be one step further than actually knowing what the numbers are, Mr. Chair, for the families. The CPI, I think, does that, as you pointed out. But what does that do then, and does it scale back their ability to pay as they look at their budget, which is certainly very, very important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And any other questions? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Marks, for being with us today. You may not be willing to answer my question, but you've been around here a long time through these changes in how we incorporated inflation. You know, one of our jobs here is to produce a balanced budget. In your estimation, does including inflation in these numbers make that job more difficult or easier?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, it would add more spending, which makes the budget harder to balance in general.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we move to the bill? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Marks, I'm curious, you know, these are really complex assumptions that are made, and there's a number of them going into it. If we're going to add inflation, I'm just curious, has there ever been what I'd call a post-mortem done on the projections? In other words, we get the February forecast, and my experience has been that even the February forecast, looking at the end of that fiscal year, there tends to be a lot of variation between what was expected and what actually happened. So one of my concerns is adding more variables to this process could actually make it harder for the legislature to come up with answers than it already is. So the question is there an analysis being done going back not only last year but the years before to see even how close the February forecast comes to the end of that fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, there is the MMB is required to provide that. I'm trying to remember the name of the report, but I think it's the Forecast Disparities Report or whatever, which is some analysis of that. I think the kind of the ultimate measure of the inflation, in a sense, is so what does the legislature actually do? And so if inflation is if the CPI is 2%, And when the legislature enacts a budget, it increases most appropriations by 2%. Apparently, it made the decision to go ahead and recognize that. Now, if the budget times are tight, chances are there aren't going to be 2% increases. So there are other factors that drive the decision probably as much or more than inflation actually would when the forecast or when the budget is actually enacted as compared to the forecast. So I'm not sure there are any good answers to the question. Those are some thoughts, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my point is that, you know, I've seen fairly large fluctuations even in that 3 or 4 month period between the February forecast and the actual 6/30 fiscal year end. And my concern is here that when we add additional information that needs additional assumptions, if we don't already have a basis for going back and kind of proving the assumptions we've been using in the past and maybe refining them a little bit, I'm not so sure it's a good time to start adding new ones because it might confuse the process more than it already does. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'll recognize one more person, and then we'll go to the bill and testimony, if that's all right with the committee. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other side of this is, and I'll be anxious to hear the testifiers. Perhaps they will give us some information about this. I wonder when it started, what we hear from both the systems of higher education and the systems of K-12 education, they give us the history and they show how we're falling behind, how we've fallen behind significantly in if inflation were factored in, they would be at a different level of state revenue. And when higher ed has that cutback from the state, they have to turn to tuition paid by the students. And when K-12 schools fall behind from lack of state funding, they have to turn to the local property tax. So the alternatives have a cost also. And I think we just really need to keep that in mind as we're thinking about budgets.
And Representative Hausman, I think we'll be hearing some of that from the testifiers on Representative Schultz's bill. Okay, we'll go Representative Schultz. This is an informational hearing, so we'll take the an overview of the bill from Representative Schultz, and I'll put it this way, kind of on behalf of both of us, being that we introduced identical bills, but I think you introduced yours first, so you're before the committee to just kind of give us a quick overview, and then we're going to take some testimony before we move to bills a little bit later. Representative Schultz.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Carlson and members of the committee. So Bill House File 150 would require MMB to include inflation when estimating the future state expenditures. So this is in the forecast. There was a comment earlier about would it be more difficult to balance our budget? We are the ones that put together the budget. So the MMB puts together the forecast that we use as a tool to put together our budget. So it doesn't specify what inflation measure to use, but we would use the expertise of folks at MMB to use what's appropriate. And I want to mention two things. In your packet, there's a comment by former Minnesota Finance Commissioners, and I'm going to quote some things from that document. But I'm first going to state a quote from the Minnesota's Council of Economic Advisors. They've been putting this in their forecast for many, many years, the statement. I just want to read it to you. You don't have it in front of you. So as it has done every year since 2003, the Council recommends that budget planning estimates for the next biennium include expected inflation in both spending and revenue projections. Council members noted that Minnesota's current practice of excluding projected changes in the prices of goods and services from a majority of the spending estimate is fundamentally misleading. It is inconsistent with both sound business practices and CBO methods and potentially encourages legislators and the public to regard the state's financial position more optimistically than the facts warrant. The omission of inflation in the spending estimates in the November 2019 budget and economic forecast understates the cost of current services as provided by law in 2022-23 by roughly $1.211 billion. And thus makes the amount of projected revenues above the cost of providing services to appear to be larger than it actually is. This distortion will increase if inflation accelerates from current levels. So that is from the Council of Economic Advisors, very respected members of academia and industry. And the column from the former commissioners who have served under Republicans, DFLs, and independent governors have said that the forecast simply serves as a reference document for the elected officials who are responsible for making appropriate decisions. It is naive to think that arbitrarily ignoring inflation pressures in the forecast will somehow control state spending. In fact, such a distorted picture of the upcoming budget period actually impairs the ability of the governor and legislature to make responsible long-term financial decisions. Further, the lack of accurate data on future financial conditions undermines public accountability for those decisions. The revenue forecast is developed by projecting changes in such economic factors as income and prices, which generate income and sales tax. No changes in tax rates are included in the baseline forecast because that's up to the governor and legislature to decide upon during their deliberations. Similarly, spending forecasts reflect the future costs of existing programs before any changes that might be agreed upon by the governor and legislature. Just as family budget planning considers both expected wage and heating cost increases, including inflation, the state budget forecast cannot pretend that forest rangers are not going to get raises or that the price of asphalt will not change. Whether or not inflation costs are fully funded in the subsequent budget is a separate policy question for the governor and legislature. So I believe the first time inflation was excluded was 1990. I believe Peter Hutchinson was the commissioner of finance at the time, and then the case that Chair Carlson mentioned in 2002. So currently we put it as a budget line. We don't put it in every budget line as inflation, and I think we should really seriously consider changing the methodology so we have more transparency and the public is well informed about what our actual budget surplus is, rather than misrepresenting our revenue accounting for inflation and not representing our spending accounting for inflation.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schultz. I think what we'll do, if it's all right with the committee, before we take questions, we'll get the testimony because that might answer some of the questions. And this is an informational hearing, so, but in preparation for when the forecast does come out, so there's a little better understanding of the inflation issue. So we'll start a list if people have questions, and let's jump to the people that are here to testify. The first one is Jane Leonard, President of Growth and Justice. And by the way, we've got a variety of viewpoints that I have requested to be heard here this morning, so I think there's a total of about seven people. But if you can stand by, Representative Schultz, in case there's some questions of you a little later. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jane Leonard, President of Growth and Justice. We're a policy and research advocacy organization that's focused on building a more inclusive, equitable, and sustainable economy in Minnesota. And this week you will be seeing the Minnesota Equity Blueprint coming out in its full glory. Representative Schultz, thank you for your introduction. You took a little bit of my thunder, but I'm going to reiterate that we too, like the previous finance commissioners, believe that it's naive to think that arbitrarily ignoring inflation pressures in the forecast will somehow control state spending. And as you stated and as they stated, such a distorted picture of the upcoming budget period actually impairs the ability of the governor and the legislature to make responsible long-term financial decisions. And that lack of accurate data on future financial conditions undermines public accountability for those decisions. I just finished doing my taxes for the year, and Representative Jaskowski, your comment about family budgeting and planning, I take to heart because we do try to encourage inflation consideration as we're making decisions about our own budget in our family. And so I think that the state budget should consider that as well in the forecast. We are not aware, as the previous finance commissioners are, of any other state that legally mandates that its budget forecast must count revenue inflation but ignore discretionary spending inflation. And of course, that makes things look better than they actually are. The current law actually enables both those who want to spend more and those who want to cut taxes to falsely claim that there are more than enough resources to do so without trade-offs. As Representative Schultz said, the column that was from last March of 2019 was written by no less than five former finance commissioners. I've had the pleasure of working with at least three of them. They include John Gunyu, Peggy Ingeson, Jay Krodowski, Tom Triplett, Pamela Wheelock. They served DFL, Independence Party governors, as well as moderate and conservative Republican governors. And we at Growth and Justice, and I personally know and respect each one of these individuals, and we wholeheartedly agree with their argument in the March column, which I believe you have in your packets as well. I want to thank you for the work that you do on behalf of all of us, citizens of Minnesota, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'd be happy to take questions either now or later.
I think what I'm going to do is open it to questions after we hear the testimony, so unless somebody can't stay until that point, we'll just hold on questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'd be happy to stay for yep.
Our excellent staff pointed out that I said the forecast was the 28th when it was released. It's the 27th, and our hearing will be on the forecast on March 3rd. I was off by a day. Okay. It's a little forgetfulness on a Monday morning, I guess. All right. We have Clark Bilger, or Bigler. I'm not sure about the Minnesota Budget Project. Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. You pronounce it Bigler?
It's Bigler, yeah.
Bigler, okay, thank you. Identify yourself for the record. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Clark Bigler Goldenrod, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we identify and promote policy solutions that expand opportunity and economic security to all Minnesotans. We particularly work in the areas of tax, budget, and economic policy. I want to thank Representative Schultz for bringing this bill forward. We strongly support House File 150, and I'm going to discuss a few reasons why. So including inflation in the forecast makes the forecast a more effective tool that gives policymakers, stakeholders, and the public a clear understanding of the state's fiscal health and helps them make better decisions. And two, making this change is good fiscal management and consistent with recommended accounting practices. To that first point, the state's budget and economic forecast are an essential tool for understanding the state's fiscal health. To be effective, forecasts should be complete and give an accurate picture to the state's commitments. And the state forecast should give us, the public and you, the policymaker, better information about the long-term cost of the decisions we're making today. This bill would ensure that the forecast includes a rough estimate of the impact of inflation on current expenditures and moves us toward these goals of a complete and accurate forecast. And that brings me to my second point, that making this change reflects good fiscal management and is consistent with recommended accounting practices. For every year since 2003, our state's Council of Economic Advisors has recommended that the state's forecast planning estimates include inflation in both spending and revenue projections. These are the set of economists who are charged with advising the executive and legislative branches through giving objective advice on economic and fiscal matters. They note that our current forecast methodology is, quote, inconsistent with both sound business practices and CBO methods. This change contained in House File 150 has also been recommended in reports such as the state's Bipartisan Budget Trends Study Commission, which was charged with ensuring budget stability back in 2009. That commission recommended that financial forecasts should be based on current law and inflation or deflation of both revenues and expenditures to provide an accurate planning perspective. And it's also important to note what this bill would not do. It does not make any budget decisions itself. The legislature still has to approve an inflationary increase in a program or services spending, but you would have the necessary information to help you make more well-informed decisions. Putting together the state budget is an extraordinary task, and it makes sense to use all the tools available to support policymakers, stakeholders, and the public to put their best ideas forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and again, we're pleased to see the committee is taking time to consider this policy.
And I should have added when I was recognizing you, Goldenrod. Thank you very much. And we have now Scott Cronquist with the Association of Pitt Proudlin School Districts. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Cronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. We represent 48 districts that enroll just about one half of the public school students in the state of Minnesota.
You're a resident of what community?
Well, actually, formerly of New Hope, Mr. Chairman, but had the pleasure of being represented by you for many years and recently moved, actually. So.
Well, I'm moving on as well.
But I heard that. Yeah.
In the same house.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Out that you were a constituent, but
yes, a long-time constituent, but unfortunately, no longer. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this important issue forward, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share a few comments. The chairman highlighted the change in 2002, but I want to back up even 1 year prior to that. Because another very significant change was made in 2001. That year, the legislature and governor decided to do away with what was called the general education levy and instead have the state assume responsibility, really, for funding education through income and sales tax collections. And then, of course, the following year, the change was made to remove inflation from the expenditure forecast. And so what I'm going to do is just highlight how that has impacted school districts. And now I can't say that there are no other factors, because certainly there have been other factors over the years, but we think those two changes have had a significant impact on our school districts. I also recognize that there are a lot of different topics you could talk about, whether or not it's which measure of inflation you should use, and I'm not going to get into those. But since 2003, so right after those two changes were made, the general education formula has lost significant ground to inflation. In fact, it would be $639 per pupil higher today had it kept pace with CPI inflation. Now, granted, total education spending, if you were going to add in things like pupil growth, you know, and the fact that we now have 40,000 more students in our public schools than we did back then, or if you're going to add in things like full-day kindergarten that have been added since then, or early learning programs, or facilities maintenance, or local referendums that have been approved by taxpayers, if you're going to add all of that in, then yes, it's gone up by more than inflation. But the general education formula, which is the single most important revenue stream for our school districts, has lost significant ground to inflation. At the same time, the special education cross-subsidy, and for those of you that don't serve on the education committee, that refers to the shortfall in our special education program, the amount that revenues are falling short of expenditures. That's currently over $700 million a year. And likewise, we have a shortfall in the English Learner program of about $100 million a year. Over the years, these have all taken a significant impact on our school districts. In fact, we just completed a budget survey. Our member districts are projecting a $93 million combined shortfall for next school year, the 2020-21 school year. Now, our platform has long called for the formula to be linked directly to inflation, but another option would be to include inflation in the budget forecast. And we think that would result in more transparency and give you, as policymakers, a lot truer picture of the financial condition of the state. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you again for the time. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And again, if those of you that are testifying can stay close if there are questions. So we now have Mark Haverman, Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mark Haven. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about this morning. This is a topic that we have studied and written about for many years, first in 2005. And over the course of years, we quickly discovered that this is a much more complex issue than how usually it gets portrayed in the newspapers. How you go about it is just as important, if not more important, than whether or not you do it. And that good arguments do exist on both the pro and con side. We came at this issue from the standpoint of neutrality, asking what perspective introduces the least amount of bias into the budgeting process. We concluded then, and we still do, that the practice of keeping it as supplementary information rather than formally including it in the forecast, but giving it a much higher discussion profile than currently exists in the economic forecast, best serves this objective. Let me quickly give you three reasons why this is the case. We believe this is the case. First and most importantly, despite the claims to the contrary, the economic forecast is also very much a budgeting tool. It's not just a reference document, and thereby introduces its own potential for its own type of intellectual dishonesty. The House fiscal brief that I believe Mr. Marks passed is something I'm going to be quoting from here. Planning estimate inflation has also been a tool to provide more flexibility for a governor and the legislature in assembling a new budget. The inflation creates a cushion of several hundred million dollars that is already counted as spending in the budget forecast. Now, that several hundred million dollars is $1.2 billion today, which is a very comfortable cushion. Including inflation enables a lot of spending on brand new or expanded government programs without ever having to properly recognize it fiscally to taxpayers as new government spending. And that new and expanded spending may have tails that actually far exceed inflationary projections going forward. Second, government has the ability to manage inflationary pressures in what is by far its largest purchased input, both with respect to the design and delivery. Approximately 60% of the implicit price deflator for state and local government, which is a inflation measure specifically targeted towards state and local government, is government compensation. Now, it's been said that the state budget cannot pretend employees aren't going to get raises, which we heard in the column that was cited earlier. But we also cannot pretend a consumer price index forecast reflects the reality of collectively bargained compensation agreements and the constructs that are employed. And I think here the dual existence of the forecast is especially significant. As a planning tool, inflation-adjusted spending amounts might estimate the cost of keeping the existing government workforce whole. As a budgeting tool, cost of living adjustments already baked into the forecast as a given would pressure negotiations to begin from that base. And finally, contrary to claims, we believe including inflation does not communicate the, quote, real cost, unquote, of state commitments and government services. Rather, it communicates some sense of the cost of how these services are currently provided under the existing laws and rules. It's really the cost of maintaining the status quo. Inflation then makes it easier to preserve current methods and practices when new ideas and strategies may be needed. All that said, this is a very important issue and a very legitimate issue that needs attention. And we do believe this issue does deserve a higher profile in the information provided in the economic forecast than it currently receives, which, as Mr. Marks identified, was largely a number and a footnote. It deserves more discussion than that. A bigger discussion of the areas of government spending that are and aren't included, inflation measures used, and where some of the greatest inflationary pressures in government do exist and why they do exist is important. To conclude, Mr. Marks, I think if I maybe paraphrasing a little bit, said it's always been a sort of struggle to figure out a way to illustrate the importance of this but not demonstrate a commitment to it. And I think keeping it as supplementary information but raising its presence in the economic forecast is the appropriate way to go about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we now have John Phelan with the Center of the American Experiment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for having me in this morning. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you a little bit about this today. My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist at the Center of the American Experiment. We're a think tank based in Golden Valley. So I just want to give some kind of background and context to this discussion. One of the things that we should know about is two things are really important. Firstly, inflation is low and expected to remain so. Inflation is a problem because it erodes the purchasing power of a unit of currency over time. At high rates of inflation, it can do so over short periods of time. Even at low rates, it can do so over long periods. But this is not Weimar Germany, it's not Zimbabwe, it's not Venezuela, it's not even America in the 1970s, when inflation hit 13% in 1980. Since 1983, inflation in the United States has averaged 2.7% annually. In the last 10 years, it's averaged 1.6%. And this is expected to continue. As of Friday, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, the five-year forward inflation expectation rate is 1.63%. Now remember, high inflation over short periods can erode the purchasing power of money. But with inflation at the low levels we have seen over the past 37 years, the two-year period of the biennium is just not long enough for this to be a significant factor. I just want to speak a little bit about the question of tail years. If we're talking about inflation in 2022 and 2023, then that would seem to me to be a discussion that you really ought to be having in 2021 when you set the budget for those years. Now, because inflation is low, we're not talking about very much money here. At the end of 2019 legislative session, Minnesota Management and Budget forecast the state government's total general fund fiscal year total spending for 2020 to come in at $24 billion. If, in the meantime, there's been inflation of 1.6%, then, in 2019 dollars, that spending will total $23.6 billion. In effect, the state government's spending will be 1.6%, or $383 million lower in real terms than forecast in 2019. For 2021, with a forecast spend of $24.5 billion and inflation of 3.2% since 2019, the state government spending will be 3.2%, or $785 million, lower in real terms than forecast in 2019. But to repeat, in 2019, this is a real terms spending reduction of 1.6%, and it's a reduction of 3.2% in 2021. Over the biennium, that adds up to a reduction of real terms spending of 2.4%. Are we really supposed to believe that Minnesota's state government is such a leanly efficient beast that spending couldn't be 2.4% lower over the biennium? Not surprisingly, Minnesotans wouldn't generally agree with that. In the fall 2019 issue of our magazine, Thinking Minnesota, we asked Minnesotans what percentage of state spending is wasteful. Among Republicans, the answer was 36.5%. Among independents, the answer was 25.4%. Among Democrats, the answer was 24.4%. Overall, Minnesotans believe that 28.2% of state government spending is wasteful. In their view, you should have no problem whatsoever finding savings of 2.4% over a biennium. Now, I'd like to put this in some context just to finish off. We've heard about, declining state government funding and declining state spending. But between 2010 and 2019, Minnesota state government general fund spending increased in real terms, because we're looking over a decade, by 35%. Spending in 2019 was higher than ever before in the state's history. In per capita terms, adjusted for inflation, state government spending was 27%, rose by 27% between 2010 and 2019. Once again, in real terms, Minnesota state government has never spent more money per resident than it does right now. Indeed, in 2019 dollars, even accounting for inflation, 2020 and 2021 are set to be the state government's highest spending years in history. When we look at the fiscal years 2022 and 2023, the numbers from the Budget and Economic Forecast show that even accounting for inflation, those years will set new records for state government spending. So again, I would say the idea that savings of 2.4% over the biennium are unthinkable just doesn't add up. Thank you very much. I'm happy to stick around and take some questions.
We're going to have questions now, and maybe how many people have a question? Because I want to limit the time to some degree so that we're sure to get – we've got several bills on the agenda. We do have the room until noon, but I would prefer to get done before noon so that the room can be cleared for other committees coming in. So it looks like we've got four people at this point, now five. Okay, Representative Hertaus. You had your hand up earlier, and so I asked you to wait until we got done with the testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Identify perhaps who you're going to ask your questions of members, and then maybe if the folks that testified could come down and sit in some of those chairs behind the podium, then we can reduce the back and forth. So, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my question would be directed to Representative Schultz, as well as to Mr. Phelan and maybe Mr. Haberman. You know, the issue of budgeting for inflation in its context is, in my judgment, is kind of interesting because there's kind of a nexus to sound money as well. And most of us in contemporary America in our lifespan have not known anything other than the experience of the cost of things continue to rise. But my reading of history shows that between 1820 and 1906, oftentimes referred to as the Age of Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, that $5 bought about the same amount of goods in 1820 as it did in 1900. It was an incredible period of sound money and stable prices. There seems to be this perpetual tension, if metaphorically I might call it a rubber band, where government is always pulling on the rubber band and the private sector is on the other end of it. And it seems like there's always this tension of the rubber band, always pulling on it. And it seems like the private sector can never really catch up. And so for those of us in my adult lifetime, I've come to realize, as I'm looking at the walking through the threshold of retirement, that my first dollar earned when I was a young man is only worth a dime today. And if you went back to 1906, it's only worth about 3 cents if you were alive in 1906. And so if we were to include inflation as part of a budget tool, and I agree with some of the comments the testifiers have made about there being a great deal of discretion with regard to putting together budgets, I would have great concern for it to being a statutory requirement, because I lived through periods as a young man trying to feed a family and having a small business of experiencing inflation in the double-digit range of 10, 12, 13%. And to try to fund these changes that were going on and going to the bank, the bankers were charging rates of 16, 17, and 18%. In fact, in their infinite wisdom, they told us, we won't borrow you the money because you can't afford it. So I guess my question to each of these people, both Representative Schultz and to the testifiers, is what do we do if this is a statute when we have runaway inflation, which, you know, maybe it isn't in the future right now, but it certainly could be. And one of the comments was made about the level of spending in Minnesota. A good case in point is some numbers recently. Last month in January, I was looking at Arizona's state budget.
Pertos, maybe if you could get to the question. I've got a relatively long list of people here that have questions. You identified two people you wanted to respond. So if you could narrow it down to the question, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to conclude my remark I opened, is that Arizona has about 40% more people than Minnesota. Its biennial budget is $24 billion. Minnesota's 48. And we've seen state spending grow in the last 7 years at nearly 50%, and annualized up, that's about 7% per year. So my question is, do you think it's good policy to build in automatically inflation into our budget?
Representative
Schultz. Chair Carlson, Representative Pertas. Well, this is in the forecast. So we want to have a tool to help us build our budget. So the inflation would be required in our forecast. It doesn't mean the legislature and the governor would actually include all of the inflation that's in the forecast in their budget. That's up to the legislature to decide. But it is fiscally responsible to have a good forecast that we can build the budget from. So you can't hide from inflation. So even if we ever, hopefully we won't see double-digit inflation, it is good to know what our programs would cost, because costs go up. Prices go up, cost of labor goes up. So to be fiscally responsible and to be consistent with general accounting principles, it is good practice to have it in our forecast. It doesn't mean that every inflationary increase is going to go into a budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. You know, and I think we have to be careful with percentages because using my rubber band anecdote, you know, a family that's trying to get by on $40,000 a year for 2% inflation, you know, that, or the assumption that there was 2% of income growth and that we can continue to grow our state spending, you know, 2% of $40,000 is an $800 family growth, but on the other hand, somebody who has $150,000 of income, still just 2%, is $3,000. So you start to get quite a tension, again, like the rubber band, between the haves and the have-nots just by building in inflation. And I think government tends to drive inflation by the spending it does. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was intrigued by and already thinking about the same direction that Mr. Phelan brought forward. As we look at the numbers, Mr. Chair, these inflation numbers in the chart that Mr. Marks brought forward are about what I understand the history to be. Government has grown at a much faster rate than these numbers. So I'd be curious, and maybe just an informational request, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Marks or somebody has put together or could put together a comparison of what the amount that government has grown in each of these years for, say, the last 10 years or so, compared to what it would have grown if simply these inflation numbers that we experienced had been applied.
That's a request of, is that something that you could do?
Yes. Mark?
Okay. Thank you. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Thielen.
Mr. Thielen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So recently my husband and I went over our budget, our monthly budget, and we discovered, you know, there might be a cheaper cell phone plan out there. And so we did some checking around, and we found that we could save about $100 a month. And so my question is, if this bill is adopted, does that act as an incentive or disincentive for government to find savings going forward? And maybe they don't even look for that now. I don't know. I think that at some time we've had, in the past, we've had some sort of incentives for those sorts of savings. I don't know how often they're applied in law, but just what your thoughts are going forward if this bill's adopted as far as government kind of shopping around and finding the best deal for the taxpayer.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that, certainly. Like I say, we're not talking about, I mean, this isn't the 70s, you know. We're not talking about huge amounts of money here. So if you say to, you know, to Department X, you know, well, inflation has raised these prices of the things that you need to purchase by, you know, 2% or something, so you need to find 2% savings somewhere else. I mean, I don't think that's the most difficult thing in the world for government. It's certainly difficult, and just to go back to a point that somebody made earlier, if you asked, you know, a low-income family, they'd struggle with that because inflation disproportionately impacts low-income families. Absolutely, this would be something that I would think a state government department should be able to deal with. And if a state government department is really going to say, look, we are so efficient that we cannot lose 2%, you know, we can't cut 2% anywhere. You know, I can't imagine the level of efficiency that would take. If that's actually true, I would applaud them all. I don't buy it, frankly. I don't think most people buy it. I think it takes a huge stretch when you look back, you know, at things like Minlars, where we spent $100 million on a driver's license system that didn't produce any driver's licenses. You know, when you look at things like DHS as a constant problem, just hemorrhaging cash. I think it's absolutely, it just beggars belief, the idea that you couldn't find over the short period with the low inflation rates we have these kinds of problems. And if we did have the inflation rates of the, you know, mid to late 1970s, like I say, we were talking up to 13%, I think that this would be a fairly small problem then in the grand scheme of problems that you would have to deal with.
Chair Carlson, may I answer that question?
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. So we do have CPI measures, chain CPIs, that actually substitute smart goods and services in a basket. when there are cheaper alternatives, you can put them in the basket. So there are CPI measures that would account for your question.
Okay, I'm going to, we got three or four more people. Representative Crisho, you'll be the last one, and then we're going to move to the bills, but there's still some in front of you. Representative Scott, were you done?
Yeah.
Okay, we're Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is actually a question for Professor Schultz. Help me out here. Mr. Thielen has focused in on, well, for one biennium, the inflation is really kind of immaterial. And I did a little math, which is always dangerous. But since 2002, when we dropped inflation out of the budget forecast for much of the state budget, simple addition, so on an uncompounded basis, the CPI has increased 39.2%. And, of course, in people's lives, they don't live 2 years at a time. They live in an overtime. So is focusing on just what this would mean for one biennium the appropriate way to look at this, or should we be thinking about how the lack of accounting for inflation compounds over time that Minnesotans look to us for services?
Do you want to be Dr. Schultz or Representative Schultz?
Representative Schultz. So we do look at the effects of not counting inflation. So when we look at the higher education budget, for instance, something that I know pretty well, we can see what the trends are without inflation and with inflation. And because we haven't incorporated inflation into our appropriation to higher education, just like K through 12, you can see a huge difference, and that burden falls on families and local school districts and students in terms of higher tuition and higher costs. So we just shifted that burden of state responsibility to families. And so when we don't account for inflation in our forecast, we don't have a real sense of what we should be budgeting, what's appropriate to be budgeting to maintain the same level of services and education that people expect from the government. So where I don't think we're being very fiscally responsible by not talking more about inflation and the effects. It would behoove us to do more discussion like some of the testifiers have mentioned, but also we do need to look long term, not 2 years, but in the tails, 4 years out when we're looking at our forecasts. So we have a sense of, do we have money for new programs or do we have money to reduce taxes? So I'm kind of tired of hearing we have this huge surplus when we don't account for inflation, and I think it would change a lot of our discussions here at the Capitol if we were more responsible. But in terms of Mr. Phelan's discussion about our overall state spending, our state budget increasing, you have to account for per capita spending of state spending. So per capita, our population has grown over time, and so our budget is going to grow just because our population has been increasing over the last 30 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, you make a good point about the transfer of costs. A few years ago, I was out door knocking in a suburban area and went to the door, and it was at the time when the state was withholding 40% of K-12 funding to school districts to help balance our budget, because we were neither willing to cut spending to balance the budget or increase taxes to balance the budget. So instead, we made school districts pay for it by withholding their funding. And the school district that I was door knocking in had actually had to go out and borrow from banks in order to make cash flow. And the door opened, and I could see two tweenish girls in the background, and Dad was there at the door, and we got talking, and I mentioned this school district's experience with the 40% withholding of K-12 funds. And he said, yeah, you know, it's nuts. I had to go out and buy laptops for both of my girls because the school district doesn't have enough textbooks. Exactly your point. We'd cost shifted a small tax increase to instead be a large purchase of laptops for his girls so that they could do their homework and advance in their K-12 studies. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, in your opening comments, you made reference to the Council of Economic Advisors. And I might remind you that in every year subsequent to that statement being included in their forecast, it's been roundly disregarded by a bipartisan manner. And so I just want to make sure that you're reminded of that. When you talk about structural balance, and that was one of the things that has been brought up by Mr. Marks, I have a question for you, and I do have a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. You talk about planning estimate inflation versus a structural balance, which we in this room talk about frequently with regard to the budget that we set on a biennial basis. So how do you reconcile planning estimate inflation in your mind as an economist versus a structural balance, which we are by constitution obligated to provide to the state of Minnesota?
Chair Carlson. So we, you know, we do have to balance our budget as a state. We can't operate like the federal government and run a deficit and accumulated debt. But we also have in our revenue forecast, you know, if you are uncomfortable with including inflation in our spending, we should calculate revenue similarly. So we should be consistent in how we do our forecast on the revenue and the spending side, rather being lopsided. So we do have to balance our budget, and we have additional revenue coming in because people's income goes up, wages go up, and so our tax revenue is going up. And similarly, on our spending side, because of inflation and costs, and some entitlement programs are automatically adjusted for inflation in health and human services, but we don't do that across the board. So because it's a planning tool, a forecast, doesn't necessarily mean that that's how our budget is going to be decided. It's just in better information for us going forward, so everyone doesn't think we have a large surplus that we should be spending on more since it's one time, and a lot of that could be accounted for inflation. So I just think it's fiscally responsible for the legislature to get the best information possible from the forecast.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I couldn't agree more with you on that point, Representative Schultz, because we don't literally have much money on the bottom line in this current session. So I would agree that we shouldn't be looking at appropriating money for new programs. Based upon what you just said, I think it would be incumbent upon us to take a look at one other item that is typically forgotten in this equation. Family incomes, when they put their budget together on an annual basis in terms of where they're going to go for summer camp, how they're going to pay for, you know, clothing for their kids, whether or not there's enough money on the bottom line to pay for the monthly expenses, they go based upon what the salaries are going to be for that year. They understand that over the course of that year, things might necessarily go up in terms of the cost for the goods and services that they need. And so there should be a reckoning to government in terms of we should not understand that everyone is going to get a pay increase, that subsequently we will extract some of that for the benefit of government services that we and others might think deemed appropriate. I'm reminded of the fact that since 1964, even when you include the growth of population, which oddly enough is going down in the state of Minnesota, pursuant to the census upcoming, the growth of government has gone up by 500%. But yet the growth of incomes has not kept pace with that, which leads me to suggest to you that we are growing government at a pace that is unsustainable for the citizens of Minnesota to pay for. When you talk about government programs, we have to be reminded of who pays the bills for those programs. It is the people that are going to work every day making a living, trying to run a business or put their kids through college or just more or less school at a K through 12 basis, and yet we are going to, in a sense, by including inflation in that equation, demand more money, because we will objectively, whether you agree with this or not, we will become and we will cede that inflationary budget adjustment to the administration. And it will circumvent the process in the legislature by determining what is best for the citizens. I think it would lead us to pay more for what we're already getting, rather than getting more for what we're paying for already. Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz. In your bill, it says inflation, but it doesn't say which measure, which inflation index would be used, because all I see is the word inflation, and we've heard different inflation measures being talked about here.
Chair Carlson, that would be up to the professionals at MMB to decide what is appropriate, because it may change based on what line item you're looking at.
Whichever is higher.
And I think the numbers that Mr. Marcus was using were based on the CPI. As far as the handouts are concerned, Representative Schultz is correct. That would be, there are different indexes, as you probably know as a former banker, maybe you're a current banker, I'm not sure. I know some of the school districts choose to advocate for something, I think they call it the government inflationary index or something like that. So that would have to be determined. Representative Vogel, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree that there are different measures, and I think if we're going to, put this in statute, that's important to define from the legislature standpoint what that is, because we're talking about 2.5 and 2.4% CPI, but the Fed is using PCE, which is 2.0, and if you look today, as the one of the testifiers was saying, the five-year forward on the TIPS is 1.64. Now, that's half of what the 2.5 and 2.4 are. So I do think if this is going to go forward, that it's a legislative directive to put in statute, and we I would hesitate to let MMB just subjectively decide one measure or another. Also, Representative Schultz, how is this going to affect and make differently the way targets are set if this is enacted compared to the way they are set now?
Chair Carlson, that's a good question. I guess it would be up to the leadership to decide how they're going to set the target and what they consider, how they consider inflation as important or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, another thing, looking at the bill, the way it's drafted, I'm wondering if it's just going to add more complexity to the information we're getting and not help us, because if indeed the targets are going to be set the same way they are now, or if it's not defined, then we're already getting that information. It's just a matter we're putting something in statute. Mr. Chair, one more question, please. Okay, so, I'm familiar with the pensions and the liability that is accrued and not reserved for. Right now, we set in statute a 7.5% return. If indeed we're going to be doing things like inflation projections, then Representative Schultz, should we also be looking at those pension liabilities at a more realistic rate? Because if we're assuming inflation at, say, around 2%, and we're assuming that long-term we're guaranteed 7.5% into infinity, the money is going to have to come from somewhere, and should that also be taken into account here?
Chair Carlson, so I believe you're talking about our MSRS pension system, and they look at the rate of return. They also have cost of living adjustments, and they have changed those over time, and they have looked at the rate of return to make sure it's reasonable and that pension is funded. So I think that we should be fiscally prudent in all aspects, not just our forecasting, but also in requirements for the MSRS system. But I think that the way we currently account for inflation is one line item, and Mr. Marks can correct me if I'm incorrect, but I think it would be better in cases to have that for every, for programs, for every line to have what the inflation and adjustment is, like we had done before 2000.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, the reason I bring up these three questions is that we're making a simple little change in statute, and yet we're affecting a whole lot of other things, and I just don't think this is ready for prime time. We, if we're going to be making changes like this, I think we have to look at it holistically, not with just simply saying we're going to add inflation on 1.110. Thank you.
Yeah, we're not in prime time right now, Representative Vogel. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is informational. I think the word inflation, and we can double check, I think was what we did in the past, but I'm not positive.
That's correct, Chair Carlson. This is reverting back to what we did before 2000.
I mean, it's being acknowledged. We didn't put in a specific index, but it was inflation. But good discussion points. Representative Fischot, you're the last one.
Thank you, Mr.
And then we'll go to the bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for, and a clarification, I'm not necessarily going to call Mr. Cromquist back up, but as I heard this, and I think this is an interesting discussion, it's not going anywhere, it's for information only, but as we talk about the education realm, of course, we have the categoricals and we have many of other things, and so what I find, and the reason this probably won't go anywhere, is we always hear about inflation anyway. Every time we talk about a budget in our finance committee, people are going to bring that up anyway and talk about it, as well as all the other terms that are out there. And the biggest reason why I think we'll have issues with this is legislators don't like to tie their own hands. They like to move things around and take care of things as they come up with. We see that with transportation scarcity funding. We see all sorts of things that happen in the education. So I don't know that we can easily get to just a inflation index for just the basic state aid when we have all these other categoricals. So I think there's lots more discussion to be had on this. This is an interesting conversation, but as you've noted in bold and caps, it's for information only. It's not going anywhere.
Okay, very good. Representative Schultz, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on. I'll just say that this was in preparation really for the forecast, which comes out on the 27th. And there will be references in the forecast to inflation, so I wanted people to have a better understanding of what some of the issues are. The first bill that we have up is Representative Stevenson. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division report for House File 1424.
Okay, and that motion is before us. Now, what this is... a motion that ultimately the bill will be going to the Judiciary Finance. So this is another one in that category of motions that ultimately will lead to re-referral. So I have the authors available if there are questions. Other than that, we'll just take the motions if there are any questions. Oh, excuse me, I didn't adopt the division report. This is, yeah, but we have to adopt it first, yeah. So that motion is before us. Any discussion on the division report? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure this bill is coming back to our committee eventually.
Yes, the next three bills come back to our committee.
Thank you for that clarification.
So any further discussion on the adoption of the division report? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Davis isn't here, but I did pause. Okay, we have the bill now before us. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1424, as amended, be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The next bill up is by Representative Eklund. Representative Olson. Or Representative Eklund, that's right. You're going to make the motion because you're on the committee and it's your bill.
Representative Eklund. Mr. Chair, I move the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law
revision report for House File 19, or for House File 998.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 998, as amended, be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
And as we mentioned with the other bill, that does come back to us. So any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We now have Representative Cleburne's bill, House File 2182. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2182 be referred without recommendation to the Long-Term Care Division.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And again, that one is in the category of one that will be returned. We now have House File 2053, Representative Cantrell.
Mr. Chair. I move the State Government Finance Division report for House File 2053.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
And Mr. Representative Chair Carlson, I move House File 2053, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register. And I believe this came back to us at the end of last session, was already on the general register.
Yeah, and being if this is going to the general register, if you could give us a brief description of the bill, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Thank you, members of the committee. House File 2053 enshrines into law the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, which was first established by an executive order from Governor Dayton in 2017 and reaffirmed by Governor Walz in 2019. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability is funded through an interagency agreement through the 24 cabinet-level agencies and seeks to ensure that government resources are utilized efficiently in terms of energy consumption and expenditure by the respective government agencies. So that's what I have for the committee, and I will turn it over to a testifier. We're not turning it over to a testifier. Well, testifier's here if there are any questions, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's the way we operate in Waste means generally. If you were here earlier, it was only because those bills, or that bill that Representative Schultz had never been to a division. So any questions? Seeing none, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 2053, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, and that motion is before us. Any discussions? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Thank you. And now we have Representative Long, House File 689. Representative Long, you want to make a motion? It's your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 689, first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. If you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a technical fix to a bill that passed the House in the public safety omnibus last year and did not pass the Senate. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission acted on that bill in the interim. And so they have implemented a five-year presumptive probation cap. Last year, this was broadly supported with bipartisan support, including from Minority Lee Garofalo, Representatives Poston, West, and Hamilton. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission was unable to make one change, which sets up a bit of an anomaly where there are certain crimes, criminal vehicular operation felonies, that have a five-year probation term, where the gross misdemeanor crime has a six-year probation term. And so this bill is simply fixing that. In terms of fiscal impact, this would have a positive fiscal impact for the state because it would reduce some prison terms from revocations of probation.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, point of clarification on this. is this an across-the-board cap on stays for sentencing?
Captain Long.
Mr. Chair, so the underlying bill, which we amended in Public Safety Committee, did have a five-year probation cap. That's not what this bill that's in front of the committee is. The Sentencing Guidelines Commission acted under their own authority to create a five-year presumptive probation cap. We're not taking up the overall question here today, but they had this anomaly that we're trying to fix, and that even both sides of the debate and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission agreed that this problem needed to be fixed. So that's what we have before us.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, could you elaborate in terms of what factors are considered with regard to the provisions in your bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair. There really aren't any factors in the bill as amended. All that we're doing is for certain criminal vehicular operation felonies, we're reducing those crime, the maximum probation term from 6 years to 5 years, to bring those in line with the felonies that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission acted on this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Long, would it be true or false that such factors as criminal history, victim impact, and the severity of the crime itself, were they not considered with regard to the cap on these sentencing guidelines?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you're asking to the action that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission took, what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission did is they implemented a five-year presumptive probation cap. It is presumptive, so the judges still have the discretion to go above the five-year cap, and there are factors that are spelled out in the Sentencing Guidelines Commission report recommendation that judges can take into account in making that determination.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Long, so would it be fair or unfair to say that the cap on this, you know, the cross-board cap does or does not factor in aggravating factors in the commission of the crime or the offense?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is discretion left to the judges under the Sentencing Guidelines Commission action, so the judges can take into account aggravating factors, which is why it's presumptive, and so they can go above the presumptive cap if there are aggravating factors.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, Representative Long, care to renew your motion?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that House File 689, First Engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The next bill up is House File 492, Representative Detmer. And I'll be recognizing Representative Torkelson to make the motions, but just this was the bill that we did have scheduled at an earlier meeting, and Representative Detmer, I think you were working on an amendment, and so requested it be laid over, and so now it's before us again.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 492, First Engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again,
you want to wait, or did you? Okay, if you want to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Amendment first. That's right.
That's DE1 amendment. This bill came up back in 2018. The accident occurred in 2016. So the parents, my constituents, have been very very anxious to get something done here in the Capitol. And
I was jumping ahead. We need to be working on the amendment. Why don't we have Representative Parkinson move the amendment?
Okay, thank you.
Explain the bill the way it's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the DE1 amendment.
Okay, that motion is before us. Then perhaps on the amendment, then Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what we had to do with the DE1 amendment we had to go to Minnesota Statutes 219 supplement because the bill was originally written in the 2018
supplement. So that's basically the change in the bills to get into the form that I would like to have it in.
Okay, so the motion is before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Detmer on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think if you've been watching the news over the last few years, this has been coming up on different news media and newspapers. And so I think you should probably have something in your packet on the proposed Brooklyn Larson bill. The Larson family, both the father and the mother, were students of mine at Forest Lake High School. And the father is a veteran, is currently a firefighter for St. Paul, all-state wrestler that I was able to coach. They were high school sweethearts, and it happened in 2016. The mother and two daughters were driving, and a guy went through a stop sign, T-boned them, and the 11-year-old was killed. What happened was the officer at the site did not fill out, check the box when there's a serious injury and a death. And what happened was the gentleman that went through the stop sign, he got off with a $130 fine. He paid online. And the parents thought that they were going to get a court hearing. So what this bill will do is, if there's a serious death, if there's a law been broken and there's a serious death or a serious injury or a death, that they would require a misdemeanor and a court appearance. So that's basically what it does. And the parents have spoken publicly. They have already forgiven the gentleman that went through the stop sign. But would like this not to happen to another family. Thank you.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I would amend the motion to have House File 492 referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, and I can speak to that quickly.
Okay, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 492 had initially been referred to the Public Safety Committee appropriately in trying to work out the scheduling last year. We wanted to make sure that the testifiers, the family in particular, had an opportunity to testify in committee. That was not possible given the schedule that we had in our committee, so we arranged for transportation to have the hearing. It was my intention that the bill come back to us, and for whatever reason, I suspect we were moving pretty quickly, the movement was to instead move this to the floor. It would be my desire to see this in committee. It does speak to expanding criminal vehicle crimes, which is appropriate in our committee. There are a couple of other bills that are related to this issue, and my hope is that we can put these concepts together. I think he's got a good concept, but I prefer our committee to properly review the proposals before us.
Representative Torkelson, would you be willing to incorporate that in your motion?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to hear from the author before I do that.
Okay, and I understand that they've talked, but I don't know what the outcome of the conversation was. But
Mr. Chair and members, I just found out about this switch today. Chair Mariani came up to me and spoke to me. You know, I did try to get a hearing in his committee last year. And thank you, Chair Hornstein, for hearing it. The parents were able to come forward. In fact, I have another bill that those parents were able to come forward to. But I would like to have this bill as a standalone bill. I don't want it to be thrown in the hopper, so to speak, because the parents have been working on this, and I hope no legislator has to go through bring bills like this forward again. We hope that we can take care of it. I would like to see it as a standalone bill if we can do that, and not be thrown in the hopper with a whole bunch of other bills. And if Chair Mariani would answer a question. Chair Mariani, would we be able to keep this bill as a standalone bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, that's precisely why we want to hear this, that there are overlapping issues related to other bills. What I don't want is for our committee to send competing concepts to the floor of the House, but rather to have a comprehensive, coordinated strategy related to these kind of offenses and tragic outcomes.
If that means that we're able to send a bill out independently, then we could certainly do that. But, you know, I really can't answer that question until the committee puts together the technical pieces that overlap relative to several other bills. Representative Heintzman has a related bill, and Representative Considine has a much bigger comprehensive bill that we did pass last year to the floor in the form of the omnibus committee. So I want to make sure that we're not creating the opposite proposals relative to a number of these bills. So it's appropriate that our committee look at those together. And if it makes sense for us to move them separately, then we'll certainly do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thanks, Chair Mirani. And again, the language of this bill was how we got it put together was the county attorney from Chisago County came, the sheriff came, and they don't want something like this to fit through the cracks again. And basically what it does, if somebody breaks the law and for some reason there's a serious injury or a death, that it would be automatic and misdemeanor, require a court appearance. After that court appearance, it could be more serious after that, but the parents just wanted to have their day in court and speak, and they would not like this to happen again to any other families. So I don't know if Jeremy Irani can promise that it'll be a standalone bill, because these parents would like to come to the Capitol and see the House do their job and getting this passed. Thank you.
Yeah, the committee has two choices. It can either be incorporated in the Torkelson motion, or we can vote on the substitute motion. So the maker of the original motion, Representative Torkelson, do you have a preference?
Well, this is a little bit uncomfortable,
Mr.
Chair.
This one, by the way, does not come back to the committee because
there's
no fiscal cost. So ours is mainly a procedural motion without getting heavily into the merits of the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was in the hearing where this bill came forward last year. It's an emotional situation, but out of deference to the chair of judiciary, I will amend my motion that this bill go to his committee with the understanding that this is a very important issue and a very personal issue, both for Representative Detmer and for the people involved. And I would certainly expect that it not be brushed aside or not given due deference.
Okay, so the motion is incorporated. And it's to public safety.
Sorry,
I think that was
safety.
The original motion that you made.
I
sometimes get mixed up judiciary, public safety. Some of the issues go both, and then transportation was in the mix here. Representative Dabney, did you have any further discussion then on the motion that it be recommended to be referred to public safety committee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Chair Mirani, thank you for taking an interest. And then I know you were busy last year, but let's go forward with this and let's do some things that, and again, I hope nobody here has to go through this with any of their constituents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And all those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And we're done. Okay, very good. Thank you, members, and meeting adjourned.